Well, it's a new year and the beginning of our second 50 years of statehood. We're going to start it with the story of a first Alaskan. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Our guest today is Willie Hensley, here to talk about his long-awaited memoir, 50 Miles from Tomorrow. The book is out now. Our number is 1-800-478-8255, toll-free. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. At a tidy 237 pages, the book is our subject today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
the Alaska Community Foundation, encouraging listeners to tune into AK every weekend. Your local public radio station has airtimes.
Each morning, the Alaska Economic Report provides updates on the most current Alaskan economic trends. APRN, providing the information you need most.
50 Miles from Tomorrow. Willie Hensley, welcome to the program. And what in the world did you mean by that title?
Actually, that wasn't my first title, believe it or not. I initially called it We Stopped Dancing. And then along the way, it got changed. I was trying to describe where my hometown was and where I was born. I was born in Kotzebue. And I think I said it was like 29 miles above the Arctic Circle, about 100 miles from the Russian mainland and 50 miles from the international dateline. And whether it's 50 or 60 or 75, I'm not sure, but I decided 50 miles from tomorrow. And it stuck.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's not bad.
Well, thank you. I think in New York at the publishers, I think they had a kind of a debate about it, and my editor backed me up, and that's why it stayed.
One thing about you is your love of the English language. You like a pun. You're clearly a person who, and it comes out in your book that you just fell in love with reading when you were young. And there was kind of a price to pay in eye strain in the years when you were growing up. There weren't that many books even to read, right?
There was wasn't enough light either.
Yeah.
And I don't know how it started, but, you know, I mentioned that we weren't permitted to take books home from school. And and in those days, I described as having reading matter consisting of Sears and Roebuck catalogs, comic books, and Bibles, which is darn near what it was.
And the Sears and Roebuck catalog would get used once you'd...
Yes, we would. Well, anything that was burnable, of course, was in danger. And I suppose that may have been why we didn't have a chance to bring books home. But because, you know, that was back in the days when we never had heat on all night, you know, it would get very, very cold, and cold enough to freeze stuff inside the house, actually. And so first thing you do in the morning was light the Primus stove and then try to get your heat going, you know. And I would read comics, and I'd use flashlights. And, of course, in those days we used candles and kerosene lamps and Coleman lamps, and Coleman lamp being the brightest. But, you know, you couldn't be too close to the lamp because other people couldn't see. And so there was a challenge there.
You were in love with education, I think, from the earliest years. And you much as there's things to be said, positive and negative about boarding schools, you kind of took to it.
Well, actually, you know... excuse me, I've got a cold, but I found some letters that my grandfather had written, and I never knew him. I only have his name, his Inupiaq name, and his English name. But it turns out that he could write, and he could read. I mean, and I never knew that, and that was just at the turn of the century, I think, one of the first generations, I think, of our own people learning to read and write another language. And I think there has been a curiosity, you know, among our people about the outside world. And I don't think it's new with me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The way that you portray it in your book, 50 Miles from Tomorrow, is this assimilation force was... Well, of course, there were the missionaries who kind of began it, but contact was sort of a slow process, really. And there was a feeling among your people that there was really something to be gained from this outside culture because they had better tools.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Yeah. Actually, you know, interestingly enough, I wanted the book to be out 2 years ago in 2007. And my thinking was it was a neat symmetry between Jamestown in 1607 and exactly 400 years later, a lot happening in between on the other end of the continent, up north on the other shore. And so I wanted to kind of give some sense of what had been transpiring and where in reality we were sort of the last holdouts insofar as, you know, total control of the landmass, you know, by the country. And try to convey some sense of that experience, at least from my own vantage point.
Do you feel that there is the way that you put it is that there's an assimilative force that was maybe associated with manifest destiny, with really genocide, that by the time it reached Alaska and particularly the Arctic Circle and so forth, I mean, clearly there were waves with the whaling and all that, mm-hmm. but in a sense, the education system never dropped that genocidal thrust when there was really no need for it anymore, but it just kept doing it.
Yes, I think I hope I tried to portray it in a way that wasn't whiny, but was trying to put, you know, that whole experience into context and how this idea of a church-state initiative type of activity began a long time ago, not in this last administration. And that is, and when you think back at it, the amount of money that was appropriated for education was very small. But many churches were already here, different denominations. And so it was quite easy for Sheldon Jackson, who was the head of the missionary organization for the Episcopals,
he was Presbyterian.
Presbyterian, yeah. When he became head of education, he found it very easy to just contract with the churches, you know, to operate the schools. And so in reality, you had both church and state coalescing, you know, in continuing what they were doing really with American Indians down in the South, and which is attempting to wean everybody away from their language and culture and essentially turn them into Westerners.
Yeah. Well, you end up being of a generation, essentially, that, this was used on. You went away to boarding schools. You were uprooted from your culture. Here you grow up in a sod house. Mm-hmm. And get off to, what was it? It was a Baptist school you ended up going mm-hmm. to in Tennessee.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And really losing losing all the whole initiation rites and everything that a young man should have to stay a part of the culture, it just is gone. And it was a sacrifice for your whole generation.
Yes. And, you know, until I started writing and to be honest, you know, I haven't written anything except my land claims paper back over 40 years ago. And until I started writing, I never really understood sort of the nature of the forces that had been changing us actually a long time before I showed up. And these pressures have been extensive and longstanding and not quite well understood, I think, by our own people. That was part of my thinking that, in a way, my own experience is reflective of tens of thousands of other people who, in some respects, had lost control of their own destiny because of the government and, in some instances, economics. And we didn't have any control over the institutions and decision-making processes that began to affect us.
Well, I think it's a very important contribution, Willie Hensley, to bring this perspective to this this matter of the cross-cultural challenge of different cultures existing together and learning to actually, you know, see with new eyes what's been going on.
Well, you know, it reminds me really of a book I read once called Fire in the Lake. And it was about the Vietnamese. And until I read Fitzgerald's book about the Vietnamese, I never really understood the Vietnam War. And I can see how having other books by our own people could help convey our own experiences. And but there are a lot of challenges to that. And when I finally realized that most writing about the Arctic and about the native people in particular has always been done by either explorers or missionaries or teachers or anthropologists. And generally speaking, they had, I think, a limited understanding of really what made the people tick. And so because we weren't colonized by, Westerners who might have or could have taught us an orthography so that we could actually put our own language, you know, into the mainstream of our own people, as did the Greenlanders, who, you know, have had a weekly newspaper in their language since the mid-1800s. You know, it's, you know, so we don't have reflections by our own people that we can go back and read about what might have happened in this cross-cultural contact that began to take place, you know, a couple hundred years ago.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the view of manifest destiny has largely been discredited now, but it doesn't mean that its fossil isn't still around, just like what happened with the education system. No earthly reason to continue wiping out the native cultures, but they still kept doing it almost out of a kind of inertia. And the same with manifest destiny. But the fact of the matter is that we're going to have to learn to coexist. Yeah. People travel a whole lot more. There's more trading. Mm-hmm. Alaska is getting more multicultural. You try and project that 50 years in the future. Our challenge in cross-cultural communication is absolutely enormous here.
Well, I think as a country, I think had we really understood the nature of other peoples and their thinking processes, I think would have saved us a lot of trouble. And I think we generally, as Americans, tend to make the assumption, well, they're like us or they would like to be like us or they should be like us. And consequently, I think, you know, understanding the sort of inherent nature of other cultures is very important.
Well, our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. In case you don't recognize the voice, it's Willie Hensley. We haven't even started on politics yet.
Oh, that's behind me.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I certainly want to talk about the Native Claims Act, but I'd like to briefly go over a little bit of politics, particularly, let's say, Ernest Greening and your encounter with him.
Oh, yeah. The senator and the student. Yes. Well, you know.
I mean, here you are. You are a student.
I talk about audacity. I mean, I was, you know, in my mid-20s, still in college, when I wrote my paper. And you know what precipitated this little confrontation? I didn't realize it was until I thought about it. I had been working on this paper for Jay Rabinowitz when I took this constitutional law course in Fairbanks at the university, and going back and look at history, laws, the Treaty of Session, court cases, just trying to understand what the heck was going on at that moment in time, and also understanding what was in the Statehood Act and the processes for land selection, and then he made a comment in the Newsminer that kind of torqued me off, and it had something to say. He said something like, well, what we need to do is pay off the natives and get on with the development of this land. Well, at first I got angry, but then I looked at it a different way, and I thought, well, wait a minute. He's saying that we need to be paid off. That must mean that he believes that we have some rights. in those days, even as late as the mid-60s, you couldn't find a statewide politician who would even say anything about natives having any rights to land, you know? And it had been pretty much ignored, or at least and so when I saw that, I decided to write him a letter. And then saying, wait a minute now, you know, if you say we have some rights, then maybe we have a right to say what kind of terms that we would like to see, you know. And anyway, that precipitated this meeting through an artist, actually, by the name of Claire Fayes, who lived in Fairbanks and wrote People of the Noatak, this book. And so he and I met at the old Nordale Hotel, you know, and so I described that situation. And I could see that he was a great senator in many ways, you know, having had, you know, been governor, hadn't been.
You're so diplomatic.
I mean, but on this issue, I knew that he was not with us. He was trying to put the blame on the Interior Department.
And indeed, you know, Don Mitchell shows very abundantly, mm-hmm. you know, that behind the scenes, he was always trying to wipe yeah. out Native
yeah.
claims.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, that was very strange because he and Atwood may have disagreed on many things. But when it comes to Native claims, I mean, they were in league together because Atwood had written profusely against the idea of reservations or reserves back in the 40s that were permitted to be created under the Indian Reorganization Act of the 1930s. And so they were pretty much in league on that.
Well, Greening, it was really probably Bartlett, at least from Mr. Mitchell's perspective, thought it was only fair in the Statehood Act that the issue of the native claims not be addressed at all.
Well, you know, but you see, that was sort of after the fact. I mean, I know we're celebrating, you know, the 50th right. anniversary of statehood, but this wasn't even addressed, you know, at the Constitutional Convention. And the person who did try was Muktuk Marston, M.R. Marston, you know, who wanted to try to provide 160 acres to Native people. Well, you know, I mean, there was, as it turns out, there was already a federal law on the books.
Allotment law.
But, yeah, the Allotment Act that nobody wanted to administer, nobody knew about in the Native community. And so so Marston was sort of shoved off in a little corner. And so, you know, had we had decent representation at the Constitutional Convention, I think we could have been able to deal with land issues, subsistence issues, language issues, education issues. So all of these things that we should have been able to have had a chance to talk about at that time really weren't talked about.
Yeah. And it probably would have been hard to – there wasn't the political congealment mm-hmm. for Alaska Natives. Yeah. I mean, so these are very, mm-hmm. very different peoples at that point mm-hmm. and not pulled together into AFN or anything like it.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it would have been – problematic to try and figure out how to do that. But boy, wouldn't it have been nice if subsistence would have been solved right there.
Well, you know, and we might have had, you know, from our perspective, maybe a better deal. You know, I don't know. You know, that's long before I was conscious. Of course, I went to Fairbanks in 60, you know, for college. And so, and I used to eat at the Constitutional Hall right there, before I was aware of all this history stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, our guest is Willie Hensley. His book is 50 Miles from Tomorrow. Tomorrow is the international dateline, as it turns out. The telephone number is 1-800-478-8255, and your calls are welcome. Let's go to Roger, joins the program from White Mountain. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Willie Hensley. Roger.
Oh, good morning, Talk Alaska personnel and listening audience. Good morning, Willie. Good morning, Steve. I got a question. During the time Native leaders and whoever else that were involved in hammering out the INGSA settlement, whose idea was it that thought out the 70-30 split for the Native corporations? That was a brilliant move. I'll hang up and listen on the radio.
God, now that he put it that way, I'd like to claim the fatherhood of that. We struggled to keep unity in the Federation. Here we were. We coalesced in 66, in October, and we had, you know, peoples from all parts of Alaska from different levels of sort of experience with the Western world. We had small groups. We had large groups. We had formerly, you know, adversarial cultural groups. And some already had gone after compensation from the federal government for takings already had been made. And so trying to come up with something that could work was a real challenge. And that 7I provision that he's referring to, I think was our recognition that you know, we wanted each region to have the potential of making it. And for those that had the possibility of having great wealth in their lands, whether timber or minerals or oil or gas, you know, we thought it made sense to have a provision that would provide an opportunity for everybody to survive. And so it's for some now it's maybe not such a popular notion, but we in NANA, you know, believed in the spirit of it and in the actuality of it, and in fact have been sharing extensively with revenues from Red Dog, for instance, and as has Cook Inlet, you know, with their revenues from the Kenai Peninsula and of course, the slope as well. So we think it's a fair provision, but I can't remember exactly when the idea kind of emerged.
Well, there has been sort of an evolutionary process with the corporations, and it's, you know, we can't imagine the state without them. Mm-hmm. At this point, I don't think we could imagine the state, but certainly 7I was some wouldn't have survived without the 7I money.
Well, going back even further than that, I mean, just think. I mean, when I was trying to do my paper in 66 as a student, you know, we were consumers. You know, we were people that other people were selling stuff to, you know, or buying our furs from us. We had never had the opportunity to manage a thing of any consequence. And for us to have gone along with this notion of putting the burden of decision-making about our lands and our capital in our own hands, you know, was really a revolutionary move. And for our own people who couldn't at that point hardly spell corporation, you know, to take on that kind of responsibility when we had not been permitted to run anything in the past, you know, was a giant move.
So what do you think, clearly when 81 came around, was it 91, right, when the alienability had to be changed on the shares, it was decided that probably they shouldn't allow the shares to be publicly traded in the native corporations. Wait, do you think the day ought to come at some point when that would happen?
Well, you know, you kind of have to look at a little bit of history to understand this whole notion. There was no particular, and there has been no particular interest by the United States in Native people maintaining great wealth. In fact, we had to fight like crazy at the 11th hour to make sure that the settlement itself didn't become a giant sieve where the land and the money would be poured in the sieve and all of a sudden it would be scattered out across the country and we would end up with nothing. Now, what happened with the Indians in the Allotment Act of 1887 was that they divided up all the land into small parcels of 160 acres. And 100 years later, or 50 years later, they had lost 100 million acres of land once that 20-year provision where they couldn't sell the land, you know, expired. Now, I think there was something of that notion, you know, in that provision that would have allowed the public trading of our shares. But, you know, we worked very, very hard on those 91 amendments to actually try to improve the act, to not to preclude the stock from being alienated, but to give the corporations and their shareholders themselves the right and responsibility to make that decision.
Let's go to William, joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Willie Hensley. William?
Yes, you're touching on exactly my question. My conception, the original Settlement Act, there was the 20-year hold on, as you described it, the alienation or the selling of the corporation stock, and that was altered by the amendment, and to a large extent, that to a considerable degree has removed the corporations from the discipline of classic capitalism, and the owners, so-called owners of the stock, there really don't have full ownership in that they can't freely sell their share if they feel it is to their individual advantage. I was wondering if Mr. Hensley, a man who I greatly admire, could comment on this impact of the amendment which removed the corporations from capitalism and put them into a quasi, I don't know, a socialist or native separation, separate from the rest of the capitalist system. I'll hang up and listen to his response.
All right, William, thank you.
Okay. I don't know that I have, you know.
It wasn't a perfect instrument, we know this.
Yeah. Well, let's put it this way. You know, it was quite a giant change in the Congress to go in the direction that they did by creating the corporations. The traditional means, of course, was working through the tribe. You know, it was the tribe that had governing responsibility over the members, and it was the tribe that was responsible for the activities on the reservation in concert with the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And so, in a way, the corporation is what might have been your tribe, in a sense, because, you know, everyone had to register. But in this case, it was turned into a corporate thing. And so to me, the perception of the corporation by the individual shareholder of a particular group is important. And so to me, I would like what I and we went after back in those early days was really an effort to try to preserve our people. And by that I mean the what made our people unique and their land that had sustained them for thousands of years, literally. And so to me, the potential alienation of the people from the land is a scary proposition, you know, because of the strong feeling that we have for the thousands of years that our people had existed on these special places. And so from when you look at it from a business perspective, you know, this gentleman is right. I mean, normally if you own stock, you could sell the stock. And of course, in this case, a group can, but it's up to their people to make that choice, you know, down the road. And of course, part of my message in the book is that, you know, we fought very, very hard to get this land. And we came within a hair of not having any of it under our own control. And so to me, for the survival of the group and their special place in history, to me, that land is very important.
Well, you just wrote us right up to the break beautifully. Our guest is Willie Hensley, author of 50 Miles from Tomorrow. There are so many different angles from which we can tackle the issues that he's put into this book. We could have him here for a whole year's worth of shows if he would last through it. It's Talk of Alaska, and we'll be back as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
the Rasmussen Foundation, partnering with Alaska's nonprofits and people to improve the quality of life throughout our state. Learn more at rasmussen.org.
APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every weekday. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
It's Talk of Alaska. Our guest is Willie Hensley. His book is out. If it sells well enough, he might write another one, he tells me. Willie, you're a Democrat. You ran against Don Young as a Democrat. You ran for lieutenant governor with Tony Knowles as a Democrat. And yet, when I look at your memoir, often as an activist for native land claims, your allies were Republicans, like Richard Nixon, for instance.
Yeah. Yes. Well, of course, I met Ted Stevens as well in the early 60s in one of his races at that time. And then at the time that I was working for Edith Bullock, who ran BNR Tug and Barge, who also was a big Republican in that part of the world. And so, to me, in those days, party, just like I don't understand all the different churches and how they differ, I never really understood. I just knew they existed, and the different parties, political parties, never really fully understanding their history. It's just that, as I said in the book, when I ran, it was almost historic that anybody who ran generally from the northwest part of Alaska was a Democrat, with few exceptions. And in those days, Alaska was very Democratic. It was beginning to change, but I ran as a Democrat and served with both Don Young and Ted Stevens, and some really great characters. Remember, this is just 7 years after statehood, and we still had some remarkable, Wendell Kay, Chuck Cicera, Nick Begich, Harold Strandberg, some Bill Moran, Ziegler from Ketchikan, all very interesting people.
But I'm thinking, when you went to Washington on the land claims, often on a shoestring, you were finding sympathetic ears on the Republican side.
Yeah. Well, you got to remember, of course, there are many people that had a role in those early days that aren't around anymore. Some who took positions when it was not easy to take a position, on this issue, because we were being perceived as tying up Alaska and its potential with the land freeze in particular. So there was a lot of tension. But I think in the course of time, as we began to have some success in getting the ear, of powerful people like Stuart Udall, the Secretary of Interior, and Senator Jackson, who chaired the Interior Committee, we all began to see that it was in the interest of Alaska and Alaskans to resolve this issue. While my book isn't a treatise on the land claim settlement, it's an element of it, of course. We all sort of evolved. I mean, even Wally Hickel evolved, because he became governor right at the critical time, when Egan lost essentially his third term bid, on a technicality. The Democrats were split. And Governor Hickel was the first one, governor, to have to face full on, this whole issue of the land freeze. Because you have to understand the structure, right? I mean, Alaska didn't have a prayer to remain a state without revenue. And here we were going with this land freeze, cutting off the revenue and cutting off the potential for the pipeline, you see. And so those pressures were really tremendous. And so we all began to look for some common ground, and thank goodness for that, because the prospect of not having a settlement was there, because it was complex.
Okay, ready for some more calls?
You bet.
All right, our guest is Willie Hensley, and Bill joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Bill.
Hi, Mr. Hensley. I have a similar situation to your grandfather. My great-grandmother wrote a diary every day for the year before she got married. The diary ran from March of 1858 to May of 1859.
Wow.
And the way I got hold of it, a woman responded to a message board in a genealogy site a couple of years ago that she was doing research for a school project at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. And she had my great-grandmother's diary, which our family didn't know existed. And evidently a collector had sold a collection of Victorian girls' diaries and gave it to the university for journalism. And I just wondered if you could explain a little bit more about how you got hold of your grandfather's letter.
Oh. Well, this is tremendous, and how fortunate you are to have those writings from so long ago. I received an email from a man who works with one of the nonprofits that I chair here in town, and he had received an email from a friend of his in Fairbanks, Candy Wagaman, who I have not met to this day. She apparently had been doing some work with the university, keeping track of archival materials, and she found this auction that was taking place in Indianapolis, Indiana. And it happens that one of the lots was a batch of letters, 2 dozen letters from Eskimos in Kotzebue, Alaska, 1915 to 1918. And lo and behold, 6 of them were written by my grandfather, you know, who I had no image of even at that point. And along with those letters were, in fact, letters from the lady who delivered me, the wife of Abraham Lincoln, Blanche Lincoln, you know. And so it's just a remarkable find. And so I tracked down the auction house and told them who I was, and they sent my email to a gentleman who had bought the letters in California, and I bought them from him. And in there were 2 photographs, just excellent photographs of my grandfather and some cohorts of his who were reindeer herders back in the early part of the 1900s. So, and to me, I'm hoping that our own people will search inside themselves to actually produce the material that is in them, you know, because I think we have to sort of deal with this issue of, you know, I had to deal with the question, well, geez, will people think I'm trying to blow myself up, you know, with a giant head by writing about myself? I mean, what I realized was that if I didn't write something, somebody was going to write something or try to write something about, you know, my own experiences and role. And I think that's something that we need to deal with in order to get the full picture, you know, of our people's experience out there in the public for our children and grandchildren to read.
Yeah, I know that some people don't even want to talk about their past to their children on a former marriage with other children and everything, and it gets lost. But if, like in your situation on the West Coast, if people would dig out their Bibles and take out the front pages, you know, and share that history of the family generations, that would be of value, as well as oral histories, of course.
Yes, we are losing some phenomenal experiences of life that, in fact, I feel completely inadequate in comparison to people who have experienced more, worked harder, done more amazing things, but yet their experiences are going, you know, unrecorded.
One of the things I thought was really significant was a few years ago, an elder died on the West Coast, and one of his relatives described his passing as, since there wasn't much written down, because of all of his knowledge and experience and everything disappearing with his death, said it was like a library burning down.
Totally. Absolutely, totally. And we've had that going on, and I'm hoping that in every region, you know, we begin to focus on our own people's history and our own perceptions and experiences, and make that a part of our curriculum so that our children will know, you know, of their own past.
Right. I agree with you. Thank you for your help, sir.
Mm-hmm. All right, Bill. Thank you. A very interesting question. And, you know, you have to say that electronic media in some ways is kind of wiping out history, but it's also enabling the connections to be made that you were able to make, that he was able to make, to get hold of these documents that he probably wouldn't have known about otherwise. So, you know, it cuts both ways. Right. Apropos of that, a question from Jay in Kodiak. All of today's Native leaders went through the same boarding school system Mr. Hensley did, and I believe came out the better for it. Are we sacrificing the leaders of the future for a token nod at cultural sensitivity by having schools in every village with as many as 10 students? Are they missing out on a quality education? So there you go. You got boarding schools, Molly Hooch.
Well, I think we should maybe be careful about putting too rosy a picture on the boarding school situation, because in reality, the way I look at it, it has been a tool to essentially demolish identities and a sense of history and languages and cultural practices that have been meaningful to our people, you know, for a long, long time. And my brother tells me about his experiences as a youngster, you know, 9 or 10 years old, being at Wrangell boarding school, and how they were taken, you know, sent away from their mothers and fathers and uncles and aunts and grandparents at this really young age. And oftentimes they couldn't speak hardly a word of English. And they were homesick. And they, somebody would start sniffling at night. And then before you knew it, the whole school was sobbing because they were so lonesome for their families. You know, and, well, I ended up, you know, 5,000 miles from home when I was 15. And I only came home once. In 4 years, because we couldn't afford for me to go back and forth. And so when you think about the human connections that are lost and ultimately an isolation that takes place, it's very sad in many ways. I mean, people, sure, they did learn, but in my opinion, some of those early bureaucrats and people responsible for education, they were very hard on our people.
Yeah, well, these memories are still very much alive, and they come out anytime we touch on this subject in the program. It's really quite a painful thing.
Yeah.
So local control of education seems to be an important thing.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if the school, I mean, is under resourced, it's a denial of this smart young person that wants to. Be a part of the modern world.
Yes, I understand. In fact, you know, we talk about Molly Hooch's decision and all that, but, you know, the thing is just like this land settlement, you know, we could not wait. We could not sit around and wait. We were going to get inundated by decisions that were being made by other people. And it was, in a way, the same situation in education. You know, had our people put the same focus on education as we put into land— You know, we might have come up with a different system, but all of a sudden you had this court case that ended up in a settlement which, you know, built these schools in every community. You know, our own people in the different regions might have come up with a different solution, you know, than finally we came up with.
Yeah. Our guest is Willie Hensley. He's author of 50 Miles From Tomorrow, a long-awaited memoir, and as he has said himself, I felt, even if it was blowing my own horn, I'd better write this book or they'd just write this stuff about me without me.
Yeah. Well, actually, there was a fellow who wanted to do that, but I finally realized he was going to write his book about me, you know, and I thought I'd give it a try.
All right. Let's go to Robert. Joins the program from Shishmaref. Robert, it's so great to hear from Shishmaref.
All right. Appreciate it. Thanks. I got a question for Mr. Hensley. Going back on the Native Land Claims Settlement Act, if you were to do it over today, what would you do a little different? I'll sit back and listen to your comment. Thank you.
Okay. You know, as I just alluded to, we never really had the time to really think about the future because, you know, our political system is, say, different than Canada. You know, it's different than Greenland. It's very, very hard to change a little law in the United States Congress. And here we were with this huge complex problem, which was moving ahead with or without us and in reaction to massive power because of the oil find, you know, at Prudhoe Bay and the need for the pipeline. You know, had we had the chance to really communicate both within our generation and a generation or two before us about how to structure something, it might have come out differently. But we really never had that opportunity. You remember, you know, from the time we finally realized the situation where the land was about to be taken by the state, it was only 5 years, you see. And in Canada, the government funded the natives to sit and talk and plan and all that. We never had that opportunity. And so coming back to the question, you know, maybe the corporation might not have been the best vehicle. I don't know. You know, we would love to have had maybe a more definitive arrangement, say, in terms of governance. I mean, the tribes existed through the Indian Reorganization Act, but in reality, the land ended up in a corporate entity as opposed to the tribe. And so we probably should have done a lot more work in how those two are going to work together. And the other thing, of course, is subsistence, you know, which is so critical to our people. We did what we could do in the first go-around, but we weren't successful. We had to wait until Anilka in 80, you know, to get the subsistence issue, the rural provision, which was the best we could do at that point in time. So those are some of the things that we might have done better. And maybe we could have had different regional entities. I mean, we could have had an Inupiat region that went all the way from the Yukon River to Kaktovik, you know, because of our common, essentially common language and culture, you know. So we might have had just one borough up there and one corporation. In fact, they had us in Bering Straits at one point in the same region, you know. And so we never had a chance to really discuss those issues like we should have.
Yeah, and the 13th was, you know, that's still a problem even now.
Well, we kind of had to succumb to that because of the chairman of the committee.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call from Anchorage at 550-8422. Willie Hensley is our guest on Talk of Alaska. You know, my friend Doreen Simmons up in Barrow has got this yen to build a sod house.
Well,
she
could read my book.
She gets homesick. Oh, I'm sure she will if she hasn't already. Mm-hmm. She gets homesick for him.
Well, this is a good, interesting point because, you know, I know nothing about writing. I didn't even know where to begin. But I wrote this one. I sat down in my house in Virginia, down in the basement, and I described the space that I was in. And then I described the two floors above me, and I described how in great detail the three sod houses that I lived in as a kid, you know. And when I sent some 14 chapters into my editor, wanting some feedback to know if I was on the right track, you'd think she'd like all this warfare over the land settlement and all the politics and the oil and the conservationists and the state and all this. No. The chapter she enjoyed the most was this little description about the Ivrulik, you know, the sod house that we lived in, which I was somewhat shocked by. But most Americans can't conceive of living in that kind of a situation that we lived in when I was a boy.
I find it fascinating. Yeah. I mean, you talk about the smell. You talk about how you really can't. You basically, they wear out, the mm-hmm. rodents and so yeah. forth burrow mm-hmm. through, and you have to mm-hmm. keep building
yeah.
them.
Yeah. In fact, I could take you, Doreen, to the last sod house we had by Ikatuk outside of Kotzebue. It's, of course, turning back into nature. It's sinking. But, yeah, they were quite small, but they were snug and warm. I mean, you know, and it didn't take much to heat them, but they were small. You know, I mean, there are all these, you know, Inupiats were calm. They had common sense. And that type of house kept us alive for thousands of years. And, in fact, a modification of that kind of house, I think, using some modern materials that I've talked with my nephew Pete about, you know, could probably work.
Huh. Well, we might see some appropriate technology move here. This could be really interesting. No, well, this is sort of a bioneering thing.
Well, I think this energy crisis, I think, should precipitate some new thinking about housing.
Yeah.
You know, because heating is dear. And in my lifetime, you know, we didn't have the luxury of having heat all night, you know. And so maybe some new thing. Or do we need the size? You know, do we need to try to figure out more ways to preserve heat?
Yeah. Well, it's something our listeners never tire of wanting to talk about. Every time we bring up energy, the phone lines light up. Willie Hensley is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
Our guest is Willie Hensley, and we only got a few minutes left. We're open for your call at 1-800-478-8255, and let's go to Alvin in Naknek. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Willie Hensley, Alvin. Alvin, are you with us?
Yeah. Yeah, hi, Willie. Hello. What I wanted to ask you is how much help was Hank Ostrowski to you guys? Because it seemed like he had all the politicians upset with him.
Well, you know, Hank was a very loving guy in many ways. You know, he and Ituk, Charlie Edwardson, were great buddies. And I wouldn't say that Hank had a significant role, but he was always there, both physically and in spirit, you know, backing us up. And that was important to us, to have ordinary Alaskans, in fact, who were non-native, you know, to be sort of in the background pushing for us.
Alvin, thanks for your call. Let's go to Haynes and John. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Yes, thank you for taking the call. I've got a comment, and I'll just go ahead and take the answer off the air. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Yeah, I'd just like to say that you shouldn't feel too bad about setting it up as a corporation, because from what I've seen, it actually has turned out to be, in many ways, a far better solution than the tribes, especially of the Southwest, and in nothing else in that it seems to give more of a sense of accountability to the shareholders and the tribal members or the corporation members. When a sudden influx of wealth does happen, it doesn't end up going necessarily to one small portion of the tribe or one family or one group of families. And although, you know, people could probably say that there is a better way or it needs more accountability to the shareholders in some cases, I think that it's much better than the alternative. Thanks for taking a call.
All right, John, thank you. You sound like the voice of experience there.
Well, you know, we have a different history up here in many ways than the lower 48 Indians. You know, I mean, the Bureau of Indian Affairs at one point in American history was a very, very, very key entity because of the uncertainty of the success of the United States in, you know, in trying to become free of England, and relationships with the American Indians and the tribes was very important to the country, and consequently the BIA had a significant role. But of course, as they moved the Indians on reservations, which were really kind of like really like prisons, their role was the Bureau was significant. It was not as significant up here in Alaska. And so I think that our assumption in the mid-60s, as audacious as it was that we were willing to take the risk and the responsibility of taking care of our assets, you know, both the capital and the land. And that was, as I mentioned earlier, a giant risk. And I think each tribe, each group, you know, still has the time, I think, in the future to try to work out the best way it thinks that it can work out, manage its their people and their assets. And I'm not saying that the corporation is the end-on and be-all. And in fact, you know, down the road, somebody may come up with some other solution where we don't have to have such a complex of entities that we do have now out there.
This comment from Gail Gallagher in Nome. Willie is someone I've always looked up to as an Alaskan who can walk in two worlds. I grew up in the bush, a native of Alaska, but not Alaska native. I appreciate what he's doing to account for the history that I grew up with. He has a voice that reaches all cultures. Well, we've got 237 pages, and you tell me there was 100 pages that they made you take out, and one of them is A Tale of Two Teds. Maybe you can give me a little bit about that, just a little sneak peek into
that
one.
Well, you know, we had a sad period in American history when Bobby Kennedy was assassinated, and his brother Teddy Kennedy, who's not well now, assumed the responsibility of running the subcommittee on Indian education that his brother headed. And he wanted to carry out, you know, the duty. So this is when the Democrats were in power, of course, he came up, brought a whole slew of Republicans and Democrats, including Mike Gravel and Ted Stevens and Senator Murphy, you know, the former actor from California, and Saxby, who became Attorney General later. They all came up, and we took this tour. You know, in fact, it was something else. We went to Bethel. You know, they went to Lowestown, you know, went to I think we went to Tuntutuliak. I forget where all we went, but it was like an armada of airplanes flying, and they probably wondered what the hell was going on. Anyway, they were doing trying to be exposed, you know, to Alaska Native issues, and Margaret Nick was, you know, became very close to Senator Kennedy. She's from the Bethel area. And then we went up to Kotzebue area. Then we went to Arctic Village. And I'll never forget going to Arctic Village. We landed there in the middle of nowhere in this gigantic plane. And somebody comes driving out with a dog team. It was a Vista volunteer from God knows where, you know. It wasn't a local person. But we went into the village. They were all in this little log cabin there. And we were kind of pressed for time. So Stevens and Ted Kennedy made a little comment. Then we were supposed to drink coffee. But then we started heading for the airport, then found out the plane couldn't start. So we ended up back in the village, you know, and had a chance to visit. And I took Kennedy around. And as we were walking by a house, the gentleman came out and invited us in. And he presented Senator Kennedy with this beautiful pair of moccasins. And, of course, Kennedy didn't have anything to give him. So he wrote on the wall, you know, in a big black pen, a note, you know, thanking him and everything. And I just often wondered what happened to that writing and that signature, you know, that was on this wall of this house in Arctic Village.
Yeah. Well, they have a nice community hall up there now. Mm-hmm. I remember that.
Well, I haven't been back since, and that's, you know, been 40 years ago. Yeah.
Well, we've only got less than a minute left. Is there anything you'd like to add here that we haven't covered? I know you're going to be doing your book tour and people have a chance.
Well, you know, I hope people forgive me for being kind of exposed again. But, you know, since my publisher, Farrar, Strauss and Giroux, sort of took a chance on me, an unknown person who'd never written anything, I feel like it's like my duty to sort of help them market it and get people. And, of course, you sort of have to believe in what you do anyway. So I hope people enjoy the book and see it as an effort to try to convey a picture that maybe other people should hear and challenge them to give their story.
I think it's just chapter one, Willie. I thank you so much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you.
Next week on Talk of Alaska, it'll be the Conference of Young Alaskans. They're finishing up today, and we'll get a report and talk over what their priorities are and what they'll try and dog through the future. Young people, it's their world. We had Gooseberry Peter at the controls, Len Anderson on the phones, Duncan Moon's our managing editor. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. From resource issues to recreational activities, APRN brings you the up-to-date information you need for life in Alaska. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.